Happening now, we'd like to welcome our viewers from across North America and around the world. This is the EdTech Situation Room, episode 310 for November the 15th, 2023. My name is Wes Fryer, and I am a middle school STEM teacher here in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I am joined, as always, by the EdTech Yoda of the North, Dr. Jason Neifer. And the hair is not looking quite COVID, but, you know, it is looking... Oh. It is looking good, so.
Yeah, it is a little longer. I had to move my semi-regular hair appointment, and so it's been getting a little fuzzy. And as my wife likes to say, she says it gets to a point where it's very feathered back, and she likes it a lot. And then right after that, it goes through like a four-week awkward stage. So I think we're right in that feathered hair moment, which, you know, as a 50-year-old guy, I'm not unhappy that I can grow this head of hair, so... but then at a certain point it just gets awkward. So I'll need to go in and get it, you know, sheared up. But, I am joining you tonight from Chattanooga, Tennessee, where I am speaking at the National Rural Education, National Rural Forum, on AI, as I'm sure you're not surprised. But real excited to be here. You know, flying in and out of Montana is always a bit of a struggle, since the number of flights, and where I live is better off than most towns, in Montana. You know, late night getting here, and then I think I have to go to the airport at 4 o'clock on Saturday morning. So, which will be 2 o'clock, according to my body's clock, but you know, you do what you gotta do. So, but I don't think tonight's talking about travel. Wes, what do we have in store for this magical hour?
Well, I think we could pretty much officially rename the show the AI show because there's a few other articles. But as always, we are going to discuss the past week's technology news and headlines through an educational lens. We will note that we'll be taking Thanksgiving week off next week, but we are going to talk about a lot of AI news, specifically open AI news, some mitigating risk AI news. We have subcategories for AI, so that tells you where we are today. Some experimentations, which I need to update mine because there's been it is so mind blowing, man. I mean, it is just, it's crazy what you can do. But we do have one hardware news article. We have one Google article. We have a couple social media articles, one media literacy article, and then we of course have our Geeks of the Week. And I'm excited to hear you talk about yours because I know you had sent me, a affiliate link or whatever for it. And I have just dabbled with it a little bit, but where would you like to start, sir? Since you have put in the lion's share of the, especially AI links, tonight. And I let me just ask before we start, any new flavors, any new twists on the presentation that you're sharing at this conference on AI and just what's happened lately? Anything?
Yeah. I think, well, there's a couple things going on in regards to that. I think I did my count the other day. I think it's 27 or 28 times I've given some form of AI presentation this year. A lot of those were to groups of school faculty. I've probably, if you include the presentations I did at NCCE earlier this year, it's probably somewhere around 2,500, maybe 3,000 folks have seen, you know, some way, shape, or form of this presentation. And I will say that, you know, I look back on my January slides from this year, and in fact, I said this the other night to someone that it felt very quaint what I was talking about, which I'm borrowing that word from Sam from OpenAI. Actually, what I said was that it was cute in comparison to where I'm going with this right now. But I do think that speaking often on this and getting questions and having back and forth with folks affords me an extraordinary luxury, which is that I have the opportunity to bounce ideas off of people a lot. And I've had coffees with members of the UM faculty, and I'm having two more next week and one the week after. And I talk to a lot of K-12 teachers, and I have a semi-regular meeting with people in around the state that we have a whole open Zoom meeting to have conversations about this stuff. And what I would say is that I do like the sparkle in people's eyes when they start to really get what the tool is, because I think that's the biggest challenge here, is that especially in a world where there's so many other distractions going on, that it's really difficult, I think, to focus on what this does for learning. But the other thing I would say, and you know, and I feel like this is a little maybe on the side of calling out some of our colleagues in the ed tech world, but I have to say if the most you're going to do with this is talk about the kind of the productivity side of this, you know, the 10 best hacks using ChatGPT kind of rhetoric, if you are on the other side of that, look at all the cool things students can do with it. Like, those are not completely worthless conversations at all, but it's just very short of the broad philosophical conversations that I think we need to be having about these technologies. And I think in a lot of ways, it's not unlike the conversations I wish we had had more in depth in the widespread availability of the internet. And so there's just so many ways where these technologies really do bring the promise of what I think people had been dreaming about in regards to, the thinking machine and the brain. Now we just need to make sure that we're being thoughtful about how we adapt to these pieces. And you'll notice I changed my lower third tonight, saying that I have a crush on AI. A friend of mine who is not a huge AI person, but accused me of having a crush on AI, and she's exactly correct. It's unrequited love, for sure. But I think that's a really good thought exercise in that, you know, I don't get too charmed by its power, right? And I'm not saying you shouldn't use it or that you shouldn't experiment with it or play with it and add it to your workflows or anything like that. But if you get too charmed by it, you're going to miss the critical conversations that I think we need to have right now. It's not something we're going to be afforded years and years and years of opportunities to think about. So what can we do to start having the critical conversations now? And that's what I would say is the tone has shifted in this quite a bit.
Man. Well, it is definitely wonderful to have the opportunity to talk about these things on an almost weekly basis and then just to play with them. I mean, yeah. I've you know, started to keep that Google Doc, and I haven't updated it in the last 7 days. And I just, ChatGPT is my main tool, and just all the different ways. And man, this thing I did today is just, anyway, we'll get to the testing. Some high level math and just some really, really cool, real cool stuff. I wonder how many schools are squandering the opportunity to talk about it without getting into any more specific detail. There's a few that are. So,
and I would even take it a step further to say too, that if you know about it and you're not talking about it with your students, you're missing another opportunity. And I have to say, the conversations I've had directly with students have been nothing short of extraordinary. It is really interesting to bring their perspective in. And that's, you know, something pretty amazing to talk about too.
Yeah. I've been having conversations with our daughter, who is at an institution with a pretty significant honor code. And the Air Force Academy, the dean, I, when we were there for Parents Weekend, I was able in the parent dialogue with the upper leadership, you know, to ask, them about the policies, and the dean answered the question and said it was up to individual instructors. She's been using it lately she used it to help her study for, a history exam and had it generate some vocabulary, and some, you know, things that help, you know, quiz her. And I think she made some Quizlets. We have an honor code at our school where the students are supposed to pledge that they did not receive any help at all on their assignment. And, I've suggested to some folks that I think we need to revisit that. Because, we're all products of our environment in terms of we're a remix of influences because we hear things, we read things, we see things, we talk about things. Certainly there are cases of explicit, like, hey, somebody wrote my paper for me, or I copied their words, or I, you know, just copied it off the web, or paid a service to do it, or used ChatGPT or whatever. But the ability to augment our capacities as thinking humans and accelerate the you know, the rate at which we can process information, the ways in which we're able to be productive in the 24 hours that we all have, because that's all we've got, right? And we got to sleep and we got to do other things. I look forward to having us share our updates in terms of playing with it. Cause I agree with you that I think helping people get their heads around it is really, really important. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely don't think people can do that simply listening to other people talk about it. Because I keep hearing expert after expert talk about it's really a fill in the blank, you know, and it's just not. It's just that. Yeah. So.
Well, and the other way I put it too is that if you're waiting for a simple one click answer to this, you are wasting your time, right? And the only way I feel like we're gonna figure out a way to shift education to balance the things that we hold most dear is to understand it first. And I've always been an incredible advocate for teachers need technology knowledge, period, end of story. And one of the reasons why I rail so much against Mark Prinsky's digital immigrants, digital native framework is there's something to that, although there's so much research has proven that to be a not very useful model for thinking about students of technology. But I do think a lot of schools use that notion as an excuse to not invest in helping their teachers become, tech savvy. And for me, I still deal with people that work in the professional development world and think teacher skills aren't all that important, or that you can just rely on your kids to teach you back. And I get that I'm not the right person to talk to about that particular perspective, because I know a lot about this stuff, not because I am a mega genius or anything. It's because I'm a nerd and I've been doing this pretty actively for, about 50 years now. Right. And I know Dr. Fryer is in the same position. We both have a nerdy upbringing. We were college debaters. I mean, what more do you need to know? But the bottom line is that's not enough this time, because I'm not sure if, unless you sit down and play with these tools, you're really going to understand what's up with it, because it's just too easy to assign like tools that really have nothing to do with it. I say usually 4 or 5 times during a typical presentation now, do not mistake this for a Google search, because this is not Google in any way, shape, or form.
Have you used the analogy of alien intelligence? First contact, second contact?
I've not, although Martin Horashi, I've heard him speak about that.
So that's what Tristan Harris of the Center for Humane Technology has done in the AI dilemma, I guess. It was their follow-up to the social dilemma. And so he's talked about that in context of just overall AI, because he says social media and the algorithms that have powered social media were our, quote, first contact with alien intelligence. And it literally is, they said it in the social dilemma. It's a supercomputer being connected, you know, hooked up to your brain to see, you know, how they can get you to click and engage and stay online longer. And the point that he makes with regard to regulation is that didn't go really well because we did essentially nothing. You know, Europe has created GDPR and has continued to advance privacy law much, much more than we have here in the United States. I think California has done a little bit and some other states have talked about it. In fact, we do have an article I would like to get to that is a social media article about a pretty big Section 230 decision that the judge made today. But, that's an interesting and kind of attention getting way of framing it, because Tristan Harris says is that, you know, now these generative AI platforms, ChatGPT, Claude, Bard, et cetera, are the second contact with alien intelligence. And I have had these I had it last Friday when I was showing our art teacher just, you know, DALL-E within ChatGPT-4 with image generation. He uses Google. He has been using Google searches with students for quite a while to help them visualize their drawings and things that they were going to make. And what he realized there is now the sky's the limit as far as what kinds of images and things like that students want to not just create. And I think this is a big fallacy is, oh my gosh, we're just going to let it do all our work. No, I don't think that's at all what's going to happen. That's not what's happening today for me, or what, you know, our art teacher is thinking about. It's, oh my gosh, look at how you can use this as a tool to then extend your own creativity and stretch, you know, stretch where you can go and what you can do even further. And so I think, I don't know what the word for this is, but as human beings, we're very quick to want to stereotype. We're very quick to want to categorize. Okay, I know you. You're this person. You fit in this category. This is a tool. This thing fits in here. And I don't think this fits in an existing schema that we have had for technology. And that's why I'm continuing to have these experiences that blow me away. I mean, it's transformative. When you have an experience where you're like, I could absolutely not have done that in that amount of time, or have done it at all. And that is happening on a multiple times a week basis, sometimes daily basis. So it's just stunning. And so I do think that one of the most important ways we can do this is by telling stories about what we are doing with it, because some of those can help people hopefully say, wow, I guess I really should take a look at that, and then engage their own imagination and creativity in using this tool and seeing that, no, indeed, this is not a Google search, ladies and gentlemen. This is far more.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Well, let's pivot to that social media article, because I'd not heard that headline.
Okay. So, and again, if you'd like to go to our links, you can go to edtechsr.com/links. I apologize to Jason before, but I will as well. We had a little bad actor malware on the website, which has hopefully been removed at this point, but I still need to be rebuilding our posts. So you can get everything latest in YouTube, Substack, and Facebook, but the links are still there. So edtechsr.com/links. This article is down under the headline of social media. This was Ars Technica today on November 15th, and the headline is, Judge tosses social media platform Section 230 blanket defense in child safety case. And I'm pretty sure that we have talked about this recently. There have been a number of state attorney generals, and I think this is like over half of the attorney generals in the country. Maybe we can Google that real quick and get that answer, have banded together to sue Meta, Facebook, and Google with YouTube and TikTok, to say that, hey, you have harmed kids and you need to be liable for this. And as a review for folks that may not be familiar, Section 230 is the part of the United States law that basically provides a fairly comprehensive blanket immunity for social media companies in terms of the content that is shared. And so what Section 230 has allowed companies to do, and some people would argue this has been a big engine for the creativity in the technology space, is they could say, hey, we have community guidelines. Hey, we have some takedown standards, and we have some people working on this. But ultimately, you know, we are protected from liability for what the users post. And so the judge in this case ruled that, and this is what the prosecutors are really going for, that the discovery process can proceed because the complaints have to do not just with the content, but with the design defects of social media. And I'll quote from the article, including lack of parental controls, insufficient age verification, complicated account deletion processes, appearance altering filters, requirements forcing users to log in to report child sexual abuse materials, and a failure to warn young adults and their parents about these defects. And so this is pretty big. There's a subtitle in the article saying blanket immunity dreams dashed. The author makes it sound, this is by Ashley Bellinger, makes it sound like the big tech companies were really not thinking this was going to be a big deal, because Section 230 has shielded them before, and they just thought that was going to step in here. But the argument is these have not been designed in ways that need to protect the public and specifically protect youth. And there have been some comparisons to big tobacco and the ways in which we had some real landmark decisions that ruled that, hey, big tobacco, have caused a lot of harms and even death. And you're going to need to be responsible for that. And you're going to need to stop that. And you're going to have to do a lot of different things to not, you know, create those kinds of harms. So I think this is a pretty big deal. And it makes me cautiously optimistic, might I say, that we're finally going to get some kind of pushback and regulation. Now, this isn't coming from Congress, and I'm not saying I'm optimistic about Congress agreeing on anything, but, you know, from the courts, you know, we have important checks and important ways in which the courts participate in the regulatory regimes and legal regimes, obviously, of the country. So your thoughts.
By the way, 42 attorneys general.
42 of 50. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah, that's in getting 42 attorneys general to agree on anything is pretty extraordinary, especially in light of kind of the modern political structure where you know, more a little more extreme views on both sides have ended up in some of these offices. But yeah, I mean, it's hard for me because I do think that this does in a way create a bit of a backlash towards free speech. But I would also argue, though, that we've got a free speech problem right now in the United States. The first one is that people don't understand free speech, right? Like that, you know, there's this assumption that free speech is absolute somehow, and it's only against the government squashing your speech. Private corporations can squash your speech all they want to. And if Facebook says that, you know, you're saying something that's against, you know, X, Y, and Z, you really have no free speech claim there. You might have other claims, but you don't have a free speech claim there for sure. You know, I was thinking about this the other day, and Wes, you've mentioned this a couple of times. I'm trying to figure out a lot of things going on in my life, you know, work and things outside of work. And I'm also trying to think about where I want to be 10 years from now. And so one of the things I'm doing right now is really reconsidering where I spend my time. And I do like social media. I do. I don't like some of its negative effects, but I do like it. But I'm now active on like 9 platforms. And so at some point, I think I need to shave some of these away and really figure out what's important to me, right? I'm unlikely to leave Facebook, although I look at it very infrequently now. I like Instagram. I don't think I'm going to leave that. But, you know, do I get off of Twitter? Do I double down on Threads? Do I double down on Mastodon? Do I double down on Blue Sky? I don't know the answer to that. And unfortunately, a lot of my friends and colleagues aren't having the same conversations across all platforms. So if I get rid of, you know, one of the above, what does that mean? Am I missing out on important stuff that I think would either inform me or amuse me? So, we'll see where this goes. It is interesting because that's been, you know, an absolute mainstay of American jurisprudence is Section 230 for a very long time. And, you know, in a lot of ways that kind of allowed the internet to grow pretty quickly. But we'll have to see, you know, where this ends up.
So are you ever challenged with the amount of text you can share on different platforms because of the different restrictions?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And I also think, too, that, I mean, I do social media for a couple of nonprofits. But it's funny because, you know, the 280 character limit in Twitter, the way to work around that has been to do a Twitter thread. Well, now Elon Musk makes that harder to keep those threads together, and they keep messing with how those are displayed. And yeah, I mean, I like short messaging. I think there's a real room for it, especially when you're sharing small bits, but it's just not a critical discussion platform.
Okay, I think I need to share this really quick because I was going to put it on Git. I still am going to put this on GitHub before I just really put it out there for everybody. Oh, it's text prep. But I haven't really told you about the text prepper and shared this link with you, have I?
No.
Okay, so here's the link. This is 3 files. I had ChatGPT create this code for me. I have been, and I had to plead with it in order to get it to do it. It's 3 files. It's an HTML file, it's a CSS styles file, and it's a JavaScript file. And before I explain what it is, you know, this is sort of, that's not like, you know, what was the name for, not OpenAI, but for Bing when Kevin Ruse had Sydney, right? Talked to Sydney for hours, and Sydney tried to, you know, talk to him and told him he loved her and he loved him and wanted him to leave his wife. So it's not quite that extreme, but it wouldn't do it. And I had to plead with it, finally get a little upset with all caps. I'm paying you to do this, and I'm just a middle school, you know, coding teacher. Your skills are way more superior to mine. And then finally said, okay. And it just gave me the code, and I've iterated with it a couple of times. But when you mention platforms, so Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, K-12 Leaders, Mastodon, Threads, Blue Sky, X, formerly Twitter. I was using this app that's now taken off the store called Text Something. And what it would do is I could put in, Twitter's 240 characters. And then it would let me put the whole thing in there. And then it would make threads for it that are within the text limit. And then it preceded everything with one of three, two of three. And so this does it. So you paste your text in at the top, you tap Mastodon has a 500 character limit. It makes the threads for you. I have check boxes so you can tell it the tags that you want appended at the end. If there's a couple tags that aren't in there, you can put them in. So you do Mastodon and Threads, which are both 500. Blue Sky has a 300 character limit. So you tap that. It just redoes it. This is all just, and then you just copy to clipboard and you do X. So I am using this every day as my own web app, and I'm going to put it on GitHub. I haven't ever done that before, but you know, I'm teaching coding. So, hey, I need to probably know how to do that and put stuff on GitHub. And then I think that I can make this a web app that I can actually put on even on iOS as well as on, Android. I did an Android app, quite a while ago. But anyway, there you go. So you're free to use that. It says Wes is social media text prepper, but it doesn't, I mean, other than having the hashtags that I like and use a lot. Anyway, it's just kind of cool. But how weird that I had to plead with ChatGPT in order to get it to do it. And then it just spit out the code. And this is one of the areas where this isn't just creative writing. And if you're not involved at all in coding, I'm not sure you are able to fully realize just what a big deal this is, because like it either works or it doesn't. And when I can describe with plain language, with English language, the specific function that I want this web page, this application, this thing, this algorithm that's gonna do stuff, and then this smart assistant writes the code, you know, it's like I have my own Spanish language, Chinese language translator that is going to fluently translate into that language, and it's going to effectively communicate. But that's not completely true, because this is also creating a thing that I can then share. I just put the link, you know, into our chat. This is just absolutely a game changer. And I'm convinced that every single person who is doing coding would be silly not to use this kind of a tool as a superpower, any more than if you were going to put up a fence in your backyard and you had the chance to have a nail gun instead of just using a hammer and nails. Like, seriously, you're just going to use your old hammer? I mean, you could, but why? Why would you possibly do that? So,
and what, remind me, what did it tell you at first? Why wouldn't it do it for you?
It told me it was going to be a big development project and require a lot of complexity. In fact, I have the links on my wfryer.me/tips. It was telling me that it would just get me started. It was sort of a conmigo. Well, I'd like to help you do this, but I'm not going to do it all for you. And I'm like, come on, give me a break. This is, and I'm arguing with it. I argue with it. Yeah. And then I win the argument, and it finally says, okay. And it just gives me the code. So to me, that is, and this is why I've kind of delayed, because I need to write a blog post about it. I got to put it on GitHub. I'll do this next week. We're off all week for Thanksgiving. But like, this is where we're dealing with something that like people have put guardrails on it, you know, to, you know, hopefully not allow people to do just dastardly and terrible things. But these were also guardrails that somebody had put on, I think, which was to say, let's not let somebody write any script that they want to do whatever they want, even though this is very innocuous. This is saying, let's make a text thread, you know, and split text into different chunks based upon these requirements. There's no way in the universe that I would have been writing the JavaScript precise to the semicolon and the, you know, quotation marks and whatever, you know, to get that thing to work. And it freaking works great. And I use it, like I said, basically every day. So yeah, that's my biggest AI ChatGPT story to tell. And in fact, I need to get out there, because I know that Eric Kurtz is collecting, you know, those kinds of stories as well, as far as things that teachers have done and just examples, right? And it's like, because what it reminds me of is when I was at the College of Education at Texas Tech for about 5 years, from something like until 2006, so like 2001 to 2006, I had FileMaker Pro, and I was able to use it and then some other tools that basically allowed me to create web-enabled databases that I could do all kinds of things with, to include like get our student teachers to put their information online to apply, and then, you know, do matches as far as schools and generate these different lists. It's a relational database. And like, that's where I'm looking forward to taking this next, is connecting it to just a spreadsheet as far as data. But I don't know if you've played much with ChatGPT's new, you know, what is it, data analysis features that they have. I have not played with those at all, but you know, when I left Texas Tech and I no longer had FileMaker, I felt like I was sort of my wings were clipped, because I could do things with data with those tools that I haven't been able to do since. And yes, yeah, MySQL and these other databases, but I was never going to become what's the Microsoft database solution that people would code in.
You don't talk about Access. You're talking about the
market. Yes, Access. Right. Yeah. I mean, I was not going to become an Access developer. But anyway, so these tools are giving us incredible powers, and it speaks to the importance of algorithmic thinking, the importance of clear English, right? Like being able to form a good prompt that says with a lot of specificity. And in my case, like, hey, it's also persuasion, right? Because maybe the AI is not going to want to do what you want, and you're going to figure out how to persuade it. So anyway, that was longer than I planned to take for that. But that, it's just like, it's just incredible.
Yeah.
Okay. I think we should talk about some AI articles. What do you think?
Sure. Well, let's, because, you know, we haven't talked about it on the news. So, I want to talk about kind of some big news, and there's a couple links from last week that I think deserve, if not our attention, are discussed. The first one is that OpenAI has released a lot of new stuff in the last week, and also has rhetorically made some claims that I think are worth our time and attention for a few minutes. But to start with, last week, and this is from a news source I didn't actually write down. Oh, it's from the OpenAI blog, that there are new releases, a ChatGPT 4 Turbo and the fine-tuning and a fine-tuning program for GPT-4. And this is they're not widely released right now. I will say that they're not that they're available to some, and they're doing rolling rollouts. But obviously, it's getting a step more powerful. The reason why I wanted to mention it, though, is because the context window has increased, and now you can share with it up to 120,000 tokens, which actually exceeds Claude's ability now to process information and documents. So you could easily upload a full book, whether it's a text file. I think you can do that with PDF, with the vision version of it. But the bottom line is that you could upload whole books now, and be able to use that as training information for what you want to respond to. And so
that's what I've done with Claude. So now you can do it with your own ChatGPT.
Right, you can do it with GPT-4, just the regular
for pay.
Yeah, for pay. And I mean, and I still think that's the under-discussed killer feature of Claude, is that the ability to analyze full text. And, you know, the demonstration I do live is taking a book, a prominent nonfiction book, for example, and asking it to, you can do it one of two ways. Obviously, it will do things like, you know, write a summary of chapter two, and it's able to do that really easily. But then you can ask it to use the precepts reported in that book in order to create something new. So if I take a book about learning science, for example, and I ask it to write a unit for ninth grade students utilizing the concepts in that book, it's able to do that pretty easily and very accurately from my general background. And to give you another idea about this, I find documents like this all the time that I think are interesting fodder for these large language models. But a couple weeks ago, I found an 80-page PDF that was a research document that basically leveled out the research-driven strategies about multiple choice design. I'm sorry, objective testing design. Really interesting stuff. A lot of data focus. In Claude, you can upload multiple documents, which I'm sure there'll be a way to do that with GPT-4 at some point. But what I did was I uploaded an open source history textbook, and then a chapter from an open source history textbook, then uploaded the guidance about how to write good multiple choice questions. And I asked it to write 25 multiple choice questions for me, keeping in mind the concepts in the book. And it did a wonderful job at it, including writing some very high level. What I mean by high level is higher level order learning skill questions. And then this one was pretty awesome. I found an hour long history lecture on YouTube from a college professor. And I did what I've done with that, which is enough views had been in there that it created an auto transcript. And so you can take that auto transcript and, you know, with Glass, or you can just copy and paste it yourself, or you can take Glass and open it up in Claude. And then I shared my document about writing good multiple choice questions. And I said, write 10 multiple choice questions based on this lecture. And it did a stellar job. And I keep thinking about, just imagine for a moment, this is for you secondary teachers out there that teach the same class five times in a row. Imagine, you know, assuming you don't have to play with it too much. And I would guess that soon enough, these tools will be elegant enough that you can do it in just one or two clicks. But, you know, after period one, you take the auto-generated transcript, you say, write five questions for me. And then tomorrow, that's the quiz to get started, right? Let's do a brief reminder of what we learned yesterday. Here's what we covered yesterday. I think there's just so many ways that these will become a really extraordinary tool. So I wanted to mention that was one of the big announcements last week from OpenAI.
I think that we should all seek people in our schools and our organizations who are creatively using these tools. We rarely have a faculty meeting, and last year at one of them, one of our, I think, Chinese language teachers just happened to mention how she, or I don't know, it was a world language teacher, so it may not have been Chinese, but anyway, one of them using it constantly to have it generating materials. And there's CuraPod. I don't know if you played with that. They had a conference here recently. It's a tool that I learned about at NC Ties. They're based out of Scandinavia. And it's a, you know, teacher specific, here, make my PowerPoint, you know, create my lesson plan. I think I've just played with it very little, but, the teachers that are creatively using it to take the content that they have in their texts and, or their course texts or whatever, you know, online materials, you know, vocabulary lists, you know, examples of articles, you know, whatever, being able to take that, manipulating it, creating content from it, things that they have good knowledge about and are able to say, you know, this is like the hallucination test. Huh? Is this a real word, you know, in Chinese or Spanish or whatever? Is this from the vocabulary? Those things are very rich. And I think what it makes me consider when it comes to like open access and thinking about open education, you know, as a teacher in a classroom, it's a little different if I'm just doing something on my own with my own Kindle book or something, but having access legally as a teacher to a DRM free version of a course text and then being able to do whatever you want with it. I think I probably shared this, but we're doing a book study on responding to affordable housing crisis and homelessness in our adult Sunday school class. And I've been having Claude, you know, all semester do a chapter summary, give me the key points, give me the 20 main vocabulary words, generate the discussion questions, you know, and in this case also give me the citations if there's any Bible verses it talks about. One of our members who's like he does restaurant stuff. Like he actually came to school last week and said, "Can we set it up? Can you teach me how to do this?" And I did. And I showed him the prompt and I gave him the file. But that required me to make the Kindle file into an open PDF, which is something that I'm legally able to do, I believe, because I've bought it and I'm just, you know, changing the medium. And so anyway, open access text. Well, imagine what we can do with these tools if you've got an open access text.
Well, and actually, Wes, when I first started experimenting with Claude, the hardest thing was to find a PDF that I could shave enough pages off of it so it was small enough to meet the context window, right? And once I did that, it was really easy to do that. And we've talked about Notebook LM, Google's Notebook LM, right?
Yes.
And you know, that's a good example of that, that, you know, at some point, and that tool is an early experiment, like, you know, Google does with every other great tool they've ever put out. They'll at some point cancel it, but I think it's a really good model for how it could be useful to really augment students' learning in a more traditional learning environment. And I have to say, I still believe there's room for lots of different kind of learning environments in an AI-driven world. I just think we can't be blind to what it introduces into the system, especially if you're going to, you know, hand out or you're going to do an online test with students. It's objective questions only. You're going to spend more time trying to lock things down unsuccessfully than you are actually trying to assess the learning component here. But, you know, for me, the Notebook LM model is so interesting because if I were a student taking particularly an undergraduate or high school class right now, I would have a whole Google document that's my notes. I would also have a PDF of the textbook. I'd have a PDF of the syllabus. I'd have another running doc of articles I find, and that's four documents, which is short of the 10 documents that it will use. And then you can just have a conversation back and forth with it, or you can create learning materials. You mentioned your kiddo was using the chat model, you know, for testing and studying. And I would be doing the same thing right now, right? Which I don't know if you remember this as you're studying for your comps, Wes, but, you know, what I did to memorize citations, and I counted afterwards. I cited like 77 citations in my comp, so my 2-day comprehensive exam. But to memorize those, you know, I start off with a 70-page notebook, and then I work down to a 5-page handout. Then I work down to 25 note cards, then to 10 note cards, and then the last 48 hours before taking the exam, I walked around the College of Education for 8 hours a day, you know, with my 5 remaining note cards, and about every 45 minutes or so, I'd walk up to a whiteboard and write an outline of what I thought a question might be with citations on it, right? That's the memory process I had to go through. That took a lot of prep to do that. Well, these tools will do that all for you to where you can just focus on the studying component of that. I don't know if I 100% believe in the relative value of that exercise from a learning standpoint. It did teach me a lot, I will tell you. But, you know, the bottom line is that these tools are just really power players in regards to processing knowledge.
Absolutely. All right. How are we doing? We got about 15 minutes left.
Yeah. Let me also mention that they also released GPTs for ChatGPT last week, and that's also a complete mind-blowing experience. Basically, it allows you to create your own GPT, but with additional context, whether it's prompts or how it will interact with you or source materials. And I purposely avoided it. I had Friday off, and I purposely avoided Friday and Saturday
And I promised myself on Sunday, I had a chore list. If I got through my chore list, I could play with the internet. So I got through my chore list and I started digging into the GPTs, and they were absolutely incredible. The one that is a pretty great example is that there was a Simpsonize Yourself one, which it basically, you uploaded a picture and it created a Simpsons version of it. And you know, that seems like very, you know, 2010, right? But it was so accurate, Wes. And I have a picture from Montreal last year, my wife and I's first big international trip since COVID, where we caught COVID, as it turns out. But we had this beautiful picture in the huge park next to the Olympic Stadium in Montreal, and it was a cute photo. I uploaded it to Simpsonize Yourself, and it created the most delightful Simpsons version of us. In fact, it is my Simpson wife, totally. Like, it nailed, absolutely nailed, Allison's look and vibe in a way that stunned me. And there are now hundreds of tools like that. And I've seen people do extraordinary things by just building their own with their own context. I've heard of professors taking all of their writing and putting them into a private one that they created themselves, just to ask if there is connections between all those works, and really amazing stuff.
And think about this, because this is actually making me thankful, like, that I haven't re-released Playing with Media, or, you know, gotten Show with Media out or whatever. Because I guess with these tools, is this, am I right? If you own the text to your stuff, right? It's all open. Yeah. So I can create PDFs of the books that I've written, of my dissertation, of every blog post I've written, perhaps. I don't know what the limit is going to be for size, but basically I can take a whole slew of text that I've written before. And then when I ask it to enhance and improve and proofread and edit, I can ask it to match the style that I've written. And so, this whole thing about, it's not going to sound like you, you know, it's going to sound like me, because it's going to be based on my own work.
I don't know if I've mentioned this before, Wes, but, I came up with this a couple of weeks ago, and I keep chuckling at myself because I feel very clever for having come up with this. But there are a lot of articles, and a lot of them are written, by college professors talking about how, you know, they know what students write like, and this is not student written. And there's actually, an Ethan Mollick, tweet, I think I have in the show notes, that dispels that, the whole notion of, you know, being able to tell or not. But I thought of it this way. Think of the number of professors in this world that have an impressively large body of work, to draw from. And if I were a creative undergraduate student that was looking to get out of an assignment, what I would do is just upload all my professor's stuff into a single document and use that as a training document for style, and then write the way my professor does, right? And, you know, I imagine too, both Wes and I have spent our time either adjacent to or in academia, and I know some professors that would read something that sounded like they wrote it and think, oh, this is brilliant. And that, you know, that's a way to do that. You know, I'm convinced that one of our ways out here is to use things like Google Docs or history in Word Online, or there are some promising tools. We're taking a close look at one called Cursive right now, which plugs into LMSs that helps you see drafts of things. But the bottom line is that, the whole notion of, writing from scratch is going to be extremely impacted by these technologies, whether we like it or not.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Let's grab a couple more articles, and then we can talk a little bit about our experimentations, or shoot, maybe we'll just have to go to the next hour. No, we're not going to do that. Okay. This is a weaponized AI social media, article that is unfortunate, but sadly, largely predictable. This is CNN from yesterday on November the 14th, how anti-Semitic hate groups are using artificial intelligence in the wake of the Hamas attacks. Hate groups, far-right trolls, have seized upon the tensions going on right now with the active war that's happening in the Middle East. And so they have utilized these generative AI tools. It says there's been a 316% increase in anti-Semitic incidents in the U.S. since the October 7th terror attack. FBI, Homeland Authority has been warning about this, domestic extremism. And so they are utilizing these tools to be able to amplify and, you know, and generate content. And it's also being, you know, archived, but, you know, 4chan communities uploading video, and we're talking videos, we're talking images, we're talking, you know, texts and polls. But basically, it's just trolls gone wild, anti-Semitic, extremist, hateful trolls gone wild. And so, unfortunately, we've talked about this extensively on the show, and this is one of the, you know, bad scenarios for the use of these kinds of tools, is that there can be, and they are being used by bad actors to do really bad things. I had a student who was actually absent, day before yesterday, I think. Maybe it was yesterday. He and his family were in Washington, D.C. for a large protest that involved thousands of folks, protesting against the anti-Semitic, hate. And it was a pro-Israel, you know, protest and demonstration. So that is a sign of the times. And while there's exciting things and wonderful things that are happening, there's also some bad things that are happening too. I'm going to pick out another article there from our list of 50.
Yeah. Let's do this one for a second, even though it's terrible and disgusting. You put this in last week, but it's the story about the AI fake nudes that have been happening. And, you know, also predictably, you know, there are tools available on the internet that you can, you know, upload a picture of someone who is fully clothed, and it will essentially AI generate a nude based on that photo. And again, completely and utterly disgusting, you know, in the hands of a, you know, short-sighted adolescent. And the other piece of this, it's also complicated, is that in a lot of cases, it's hard to know even what law that the person broke, right? Because, you know, in the same way that it may be creepy, it might not be weird for someone to draw an inappropriate thing in their notebook at home, for example, right? But this is one of the reasons why, you know, in the same way that technology obviously brought new challenges in social norms when the internet became a thing in everyone's hands in the late 90s and early 2000s, AI will do the exact same thing. And so we need to be very thoughtful, I think, about being on the lookout for antisocial behavior, and also explain to kids, you know, why it's important to not use these tools in the harm of others. And I know that sounds like a simplistic solution, but I think at least would get us started in trying to find a way to balance out all these particular needs.
And one of the things that is really a complicating factor is the fact that some of these tools have been open sourced. So while tools like ChatGPT and, you know, Microsoft's implementation of OpenAI, which I guess, and I don't know if you have this article, they're rebranding it. So it's not going to be the Copilot. It's going to be the, you know, AI chat or something like that. Bing chat, I think.
Oh, wow.
They've rebranded that. You can just download Stable Diffusion and run it on your machine. Yeah. And those tools are, you know, I don't think as advanced and just incredible and also fast, but they can do all kinds of things, to include face swaps and the kinds of things that are described in this article. So I think that this is an example of something that we definitely want parents to be aware of. And then depending upon the age of students, and the situation, it is something to be aware of, in the realm and context of digital citizenship, because, you know, for quite a while, I think there have been some groups that have really been, you know, cautioning teens about selfies and making sure they don't allow themselves to be photographed in a compromising way, that, you know, that image might find its way onto someone else's device. And we had a situation at one of our high schools. We were back in Oklahoma with the granddaughter of one of our members of our men's group who's since passed away. But anyway, this young woman is a high school student, ended up moving away with her family because the embarrassment was so extreme. And that was a photograph that was taken that had nothing to do with AI, but you know, that was the impact of it. And unfortunately, I think we are going to see more news headlines about that kind of thing, because unfortunately bullying and just, you know, hurtful treatment of other people is, like, I guess, baked into an apology. So that is unfortunate, and yeah, that's going to continue to happen. And I don't think there is a, quote, solution to this, which
no,
we're not going to have if Congress tomorrow was to say, hey, we're all going to cooperate, and we've cooperated so well on this, you know, Attorney's General initiative to hold, you know, social media companies accountable. Now we're going to move against these, you know, deep fakes and all, they're not going to be able to stop it.
Yep.
All right. Let's see. Oh, I wanted to tell one quick story. You had that Ethan Mollick, can writing experts detect AI? Yeah. I had a chance to be on a Zoom call for the TIP Teachers, which is out of the University of Washington. And the first Monday of the month they meet, and in the sharing between teachers, there was discussion about these models. Can the models catch the students and identify? And what they did was their own little experiment. And so they took examples of writing, I think, from teachers and students that they had actually written. And then they generated some with AI, and multiple times the actual writing that a teacher or student had written was identified by the model that they were using as, oh, this was AI generated. And so that personal little experiment that they did really highlighted probably what Mollick is saying there, I'm going to guess, which is that there is no silver bullet for trying to say, yes, you know, pay this company, it'll flag all the AI generated content.
Interesting. And then I'll just share, one other, well, let me talk about one of my experiments. We haven't talked about, where am I here? No, we talked about that last week. Let's just move into our Geeks of the Week, 'cause that's what I want to talk about anyways. So you mind if I start?
Go for it.
So I found an app over the weekend, or actually I should say last week, that I really like, and it's a really cool idea. I don't know if I'm going to continue to pay for it or not. And in fact, the link I share is actually, you get your first month for free. So it's I think it's $5 a month, or maybe it's $10 a month. I think it's $5 a month, but it's called Snipped, and it's a podcast aggregator. So, you know, there's nothing that usual about a podcast aggregators for sure, but the reason why I like it is because it will both create an AI summary for you of the episode. So in other words, it evaluates it with AI. It will also create chapters for you, so that if you want to look at a particular piece of it, or one of the topics in there, then you could just skip right to the thing you really want to listen to. And because it also creates an auto transcript, you can literally, as you're listening, look at the text as it's moving along on the screen, clip the text and share it to socials or otherwise note it. And it's got a really clever model. It's not for free. You don't get unlimited numbers of those. But once one person uses their AI credits, and you get like 900 minutes a month of podcast processing, once one person does it, they don't make someone else pay for it. So most of the major podcasts, are already AI'd up by Snipped before you get there. So, for example, when Hard Fork was released last week, by the time I got there, it was 12 hours later, and someone had already snipped it. So all I had to do was take advantage of their snipping. Gave me an AI-generated summary, and for some reason doesn't have our most recent. Oh, it's because we don't have a website right now. Okay, that makes sense. So
our RSS feed is generated off of our website, and yeah. So I've
yeah, okay. I, yeah, so
I gotta
got it now. It took me a second to figure that
I'll get that. Yeah, I'm working on that for Thanksgiving.
It had an older podcast there that someone had paid to have AI'd up for whatever reason. Thank you, listener.
I think I did it because that was one of the first ones that I tried. It was like episode 252, so yeah, that was probably still me.
We appreciate people listening to our conversations with us, but it's really just our conversation. So,
it's just Wes and Jason. That's all right.
Yeah, but it did a really great job of summarizing what we were talking about and creating chapters. And you know, if you are a power podcast listener that's really just using it not just to pass the time, but instead to, you know, really you know, process information and, you know, capture it in a bucket, to use an older analogy that I really liked to the internet, it's a really wonderful way to do it. So it's one of the first great apps I've seen other than image generators on a phone that really shows some really clever uses of using artificial intelligence.
Are you using the ChatGPT app on your iPhone?
Oh, much? Yeah. And having the conversations with it?
Yeah. Okay. Well, Jason and I do have a bunch of experiments, and I went ahead and updated my page, but that page of experiments is at my shortened link, wfryer.me/tips. And I did update with a bunch of other things, but I put the link to the text prepper that I've made. But my main geek of the week is how to make a QR code in Google Docs. And you are the Google wizard, sir. So did you know this, that there's a built-in tool for QR code creation in Chrome and Google Docs?
I think I did do that. No, that's got the little dinosaur in it, right?
Yeah. So I didn't know this. Actually, I think a student taught it to me. So you have to be in Chrome. You have the Google Doc loaded up. And then you don't go up like to the share square or the three dots or whatever. It's in the Omni bar, in the text, in the bar, there is a link that you click on, and that will generate a QR code right away, and you can download it or you can save it. So anyway, that's just a small thing, but it's kind of cool because I've been teaching my students. The one that I'm using now, Adobe, if you Google QR code generator Adobe, I am using theirs. It's free. It's clean. There's no ads. They don't even try to get you to, sign up for anything. Free to use forever. No credit card. So that's the one that I'm using. I'll put that one in as a geek of the week too. So that one will let you generate a QR code, obviously, for anything. You know, what we're talking about with, Google Docs is a Google Docs specific thing. Oh my gosh. I think this sets a record for the least number of articles we've talked about.
Well, actually, it goes back to our early days when sometimes we would, wax poetically about four articles. So I guess.
Right. We're just going back in time. All right. Well, Jason, when you're not here, and you're not, you know, traversing the continent talking about AI again, where can people find you?
Best place to find me right now is on Twitter, TechSavvyTeach, although I am working on getting a webpage back up because people keep asking for a URL to contact me later. So all right. TechSavvyTeach on X.
And I will extend the invitation if you would like me to host your site, no problem. I can just provide you with the DNS pointers for the domain and then set you up a WordPress or whatever you want. So okay,
thank you.
All right. So I am at all those different places that we talked about, still on Twitter. But if I was going to invest in one, I would invest in Mastodon. In fact, I'm going to try to set my wife up. She's always listening to space podcasts as well as other wonder. She's like really into Oprah's podcast now and just really, really good stuff. And I was like, you got to share this on somewhere. So I'm going to set her up with Mastodon. But all those links for me are at wesfryer.com/after. We did have a live viewer for a while. I'm not sure who it was, but we would love for you to join us live online. And if you do, let us know you're here. We will promise to pay attention and not just, you know, ramble on. But this has been the EdTech Situation Room. We are an almost weekly podcast coming to you live at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 7 p.m. Mountain, whatever else that translates to in your time zone, live streaming to both Facebook and to YouTube. Normally, you will be able to get our podcasts quickly on our website. You can certainly access all the links, but hopefully after Thanksgiving, you'll have all of our updated podcast links there as well. Thankfully, we haven't lost any data because all of our podcasts reside on the Amazon S3 cloud, and we have the Internet Archive as well as our Substack to draw back on as far as all of our contact. But we encourage you to stay savvy, stay safe, join us live if you can, and keep playing with AI and keep sharing your stories of AI, because I think that's going to be important to our individual and collective journeys as educators, citizens, and human beings intersecting with this alien intelligence. Good night, everybody.
Good night.